Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role do families play in the formation of our identities and in the steps we take to either imitate or reject their examples? When Mark Whitaker's parents fell in love in the mid-1950s, the simple fact of their relationship was considered scandalous, in part because Whitaker's mother was a young professor and his father a student, but also because his mother was white and his father black. Their divorce a few years later left Whitaker and his brother mostly in the care of their depressed and financially struggling mother. But their experiences with their father also left a deep imprint, which has shaped Whitaker's choices as both a professional journalist and a husband and father. Mark Whitaker is executive vice president and managing editor of CNN Worldwide. He previously served as Washington bureau chief for NBC News, and before that was editor of Newsweek magazine. His new book is called My Long Trip Home, a family memoir. Mark, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. So your memories are at the heart of this book, but you also realized you needed to do some journalistic research in order to tell the whole story. And ultimately, you learned a lot of things that you had not known before.
That's right. Because of the circumstances that you just described, my parents' unusual marriage, an interracial marriage in the mid-1950s, when it was still illegal for blacks and whites to marry in most states. And the fact that my parents also came from very interesting backgrounds. My father had been raised in Pittsburgh. Both of his parents were undertakers. I call it sort of a world of cross between August Wilson and Six Feet Under. my mother grew up in French Africa and then in France, and came to America in 1940 with five of her sisters to stay with American families during the war with other refugee children fleeing Europe. And my grandfather stayed behind. He was a Protestant minister in a little village called Le Chambon-sur-Lignon in the mountains of central France that he and his fellow clergymen there organized into a kind of underground railroad to hide what would ultimately be thousands of Jews during the war. People had, when they heard that story from me, said, you know, that could be a book someday. But, of course, there was a sad part of it, too, which was what happened after my parents got divorced. As you said, my mother, was left to raise my brother and me on her own. With my father stopped paying child support. She struggled financially and emotionally. I was so unhappy and depressed about being separated from my father that I became obese, almost 100 pounds overweight at one point by the time I was an early teen. And my father spiraled into an alcoholic descent that really he was a student of African politics and had a sort of brilliant early career, but it all came apart because of his drinking and ended up losing several jobs and, you know, suffering from the DTs that I had to nurse him through later on. So that part of the story was one that I wasn't sure I necessarily wanted other people to know, and in a lot of ways I had sort of spent an entire adult life running away, not running away from, but at least, you know, trying to sort of not repeat and forget in many ways. My father died finally just after Thanksgiving 2008. And a year later, to the day, I woke up in the middle of the night just with this sort of epiphany that I wanted to try to write the story. And, you know, I myself to this day don't know quite what all my motivations were. Obviously, there was something, still a strong need, I think, for me to sort of wrestle with my father's memory and what it had meant and what his role in my life had been. And I started to write sort of as conventional. I had, you know, never written a memoir, and I sort of started to write from memory, which is how I assumed most people did it. But I realized very quickly there were a lot of things that I didn't know or that I didn't know for sure. Gaps, you know, in my life and his life where we had been separated, other things, sort of secrets, why my parents had divorced, what had come between them, a lot of the other details, details about the family history on both sides. And because I had been trained as a reporter, that's what I had you know, been doing professionally for 30 years, I decided I had to report the story. And so I started finding all the sources who were still alive and could remember the events to interview, asking them for letters and documents, researching a lot of the history surrounding my parents' lives, the civil rights movement, World War II Europe, the Black Power struggle, the feminist movement, which helped my mother ultimately sort of come out of her depression. And it was really the reporting of the story that I became completely obsessed by. And so ultimately what I've written is a different kind of memoir. It's part memory, but also the result of the reporting and contrasting what I thought I knew with what I found out in the reporting.
I wonder if that dispassionate approach, at least in terms of the research, made it easier for you to wade into territory that, as you mentioned, you weren't sure if you wanted to share it with other people, let alone know some of this yourself.
There's no question about that. I think that it gave me a little bit of emotional distance, both in the process of reporting and talking and doing the interviews, but and also in the writing of it. But I also think for the people I was talking to themselves, I think it made it a lot easier. You know, a lot of people when they hear about my book say, "Well, gosh, you know, what was it like to talk to your mother about these things? What was it like to talk to other, you know, girlfriends and ex-wives of your father?" You know, I could never do that. I couldn't imagine doing that. And you know, the fact is that when I did approach a lot of the sources I talked to, a number of them were quite wary at first. Others said, "Well, you know, I don't really remember much." And I said, "Well, look, you know, let me come and talk to you and let's see how it goes." Because a lot of them were elderly, I always made sure that I scheduled the interview for early in the day so they would be wide awake and have a lot of energy, and also made sure that they didn't have anything else they had to run to, so that once we got started, we could really spend some time. And I think that once they saw that I was approaching it as a reporter, I wasn't passing judgment, I was asking questions, I was just trying to sort of get to the facts rather than passing judgment or confronting them with my own feelings about what had happened, I think it made it a lot easier for them to talk to me as well.
So let's talk about how your parents met. Your mother was in her mid-20s. She had this promising career teaching at Swarthmore. Had she given much thought to her prospects for marriage at that time, which to get to 27, 28 in the mid-50s and not be married was considered sort of taboo?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I guess she was 29 when my parents married. Let's see. No, I guess she was 30, so she was 29 when they met.
Mm-hmm.
She was the oldest of eight sisters. She had seven younger sisters.
There's some great pictures of them in the book, by the way.
Yeah, and a number of her younger sisters were already married. And, you know, she had five of them had come with her to America during the war, and then she and one other sister stayed and finished college and made their careers in America and ultimately married Americans. The other four went back, a number of her younger sisters were already married. And so, you know, my mother had started a career as a French professor, and had a couple of boyfriends up to that point, but nothing terribly serious. She'd really been sort of focused on her career. But I wouldn't say that what I found out was that she was looking for someone to get involved with at the time. In fact, what I found out was that it was really my father who pursued her, which was a bit of a surprise to me because my mother is still and was then very, very shy, whereas my father was very charismatic and outgoing and magnetic. And I had always assumed that she had fallen for him, but I found out that it was the other way around. But I think once he started to pursue and court her, she was attracted to him for a variety of reasons. But I do think that the fact that she was almost 30, and as you say, in those days, I was actually at an event last night where Gloria Steinem was being given an award, and she was talking about how in those days, if you weren't married by the time you were 30, you were considered a failure as a woman. So I think, you know, that probably played a role in her interest in my father as well.
And you say that in some ways, your mother may have fallen in love with the idea of him as much as the human being that he was, even noting that he was very charming and very handsome and all that, there wasn't necessarily a personal attraction.
Well, you know, I think there was, but you know, you have to understand, or I had to understand, what attracted my mother. And my mother was very, very devoted to her father, who was a French Protestant minister, also a scholar and a teacher, in addition to being the religious leader of this little town, Le Chambon in France. He also had founded a boarding school, a secondary school called Le Collège Savonol, where actually ultimately a lot of Americans ended up going, you know, over summers and years in France. He also was a passionate believer in nonviolence, and a student of Gandhi and other philosophers of nonviolence. And my father had, although he was raised a Black Baptist in Pittsburgh, he had become interested in high school before he arrived at Swarthmore in Quakerism. His Sunday school teacher at Bethany Baptist Church in Pittsburgh had suggested that he might apply to go to a summer work camp program that the Quakers ran. And he did that, and he ended up, at first he was sort of skeptical about the whole thing and the Quaker philosophy of nonviolence and so forth and so on, but he found himself very taken with it over that summer. He did a second work camp experience the next summer, actually in Harlan County, Kentucky, where he had some run-ins with local the sort of local hillbillies, which were quite frightening at the time that I talk about in the book. But you know, he arrived at Swarthmore having essentially converted to Quakerism and embraced the whole philosophy of nonviolence. So to some degree, I think my mother was attracted partly by his ideas, also by, I think, the idea of their relationship, this interracial relationship, represented. I also speculate in the book, and it's a little bit of speculation, although I talked to my mother, she didn't disagree with me, that there may have been a physical attraction that was based partly on the fact that my mother had spent her early years up to the age of seven or so, in French Africa, where my grandparents were missionaries. So she grew up around a lot of Black men in Africa, and there may have been sort of, you know, a kind of unconscious physical attraction to my father because of that.
Mark Whitaker is my guest. He's Executive Vice President and Managing Editor of CNN Worldwide and author of the new book, My Long Trip Home, A Family Memoir.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
I'm Chris Boyd. Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is CNN Worldwide Executive Vice President and Managing Editor Mark Whitaker. His new book is called My Long Trip Home, a Family Memoir. Mark, you told us about the admiring relationship your mother had with her father. This was not the case for your father. He, in fact, had a very troubled relationship with his dad.
That's right, and I had heard about that growing up, but I didn't know the details. And I didn't really know my grandfather all that well, partly because he had suffered a stroke, a very severe stroke, when I was just a few years old. So when we went to visit my grandparents, he was in a wheelchair and often just sort of off in the corner and couldn't really communicate, and often he had staying at a nursing home where my grandmother would where he spent most of the last 20 years of his life, and I had heard from my mother that after my parents split up that they had a very difficult relationship. One of the things I found out, though, in the course of reporting this book, was what a remarkably attractive and successful and magnetic person he was in his own right. He had been born on a tenant farm in Texas in 1898, the 13th son of a former slave, started his schooling literally in a one-room log schoolhouse, only went through about the seventh grade, and then as a teenager had made his way north as part of the Great Black Migration that Isabel Wilkerson and others have written so well about, to Pittsburgh to make his living in the steel plants, started as an ordinary laborer, sort of talked his way into a program to become trained as a machinist, and then as a side job started working as a chauffeur for a white funeral owner. And at that time, with all of the black folks who were moving into Pittsburgh, this funeral owner had decided that this presented a problem for him, which is that he didn't really want to have to bury black people because it would be bad for his business with his white clientele, and that what Pittsburgh needed were black morticians who could bury their own kind. So he had gotten to know my granddad as he was being driven around, decided that he thought he was quite able and could do all the training and get all the certificates he needed to become an undertaker, and basically offered to stake him in the business, which is how my granddad had gotten started in the undertaking business. And ultimately, he became very successful at it. Then when he married my grandmother, who was his second wife, his first wife had died of tuberculosis, encouraged her to get an undertaker's degree as well. Now they ultimately divorced, partly because my granddad had an eye for other women, mm-hmm. Let's say. Actually, both operated sort of competitive funeral homes at one point. But so my grandfather turned out to be this really compelling figure, but he was very tough on my dad. He was very busy with his own career. He had these very sort of strict old-fashioned ideas about child rearing. I think he probably thought that my father was a little bit spoiled by his mother and by his older sisters. One of the first things that my father told my mother when they first started to meet in secret was that his father had beat him as a child, that he hated his name. My father was named after my granddad. My granddad's name was Cleophas Sylvester Whitaker, and my father was Cleophas Sylvester Whitaker Jr., and my father hated the name Cleophas. He was called Junior as a kid. He also considered that demeaning. At one point as a teenager, he went on a sort of a protest strike and refused to talk to anybody who wouldn't call him by the name Sil, which is short for Sylvester, his middle name, which is what he wanted to be called. he had a lot of anger towards his father, I think ultimately it was a source of, I think, a lot of the anguish that you know created and led to a lot of the problems that he had as an adult.
A family friend tried to warn your mother about the dangers of marrying an angry man. Did she simply not see it at the time, or did she think, well, he's angry at his father, but not at the whole world, and certainly not at me? Why did she sort of ignore that?
Well, I'm not sure that she saw it so clearly at that point. You know, she saw flashes of anger. She saw how angry he could get when he talked about his father. She saw that he could get very angry about when he was the target of what he perceived as racism. I talk about a scene early in their courtship before they got married when they were driving around on the main line between Swarthmore and Philadelphia. My mother didn't drive at the time, actually, but had convinced her to spend some of her savings to buy a secondhand car so they could sneak away off the campus at Swarthmore together. And one of these days they were driving outside of Philadelphia, and a white policeman stopped them. And my father hadn't been speeding. He hadn't gone through a traffic light. And the policeman sort of questioned them and then let them go. And my father sort of was polite to the policeman, but as soon as they drove off, he exploded with rage that the only reason that this policeman had stopped them was because he was a black man riding around with a white woman. So she had definitely seen flashes of it, but there was another side of my father, which was, you know, very friendly and fun-loving and charming. And I think, I think she at the time, was attracted to those qualities and less sensitive to the anger. But as the years went on, I think she saw more and more of the anger. And I think that came out also more and more as, he started to drink more.
Well, let's talk about that, because they moved to Princeton for your father to continue his studies there. How different was the social scene among academics from what they had been used to in Pennsylvania?
Swarthmore was a dry town, mm-hmm. partly because of its Quaker sort of roots. You could drink privately in people's homes, but there was no public drinking. So there were no bars, and when people did get together generally in their homes, professors and students and so forth, it was wine or sherry. Princeton, on the other hand, had a heavy drinking scene. And one of my father's mentors, he had enrolled after he got his degree at Swarthmore as the first black doctoral candidate in politics in the Department of Politics at Princeton. And so he was commuting back and forth for a couple of years, first doing his coursework and then later to Princeton, and later they moved there. And he had a mentor named Hube Wilson, Harper Hubert Wilson, who was a sort of legendary professor there, but also an alcoholic. I mean, so a very, very serious drinker. And I think my father sort of fell under his sway and his influence. There was a lot of other things that I talk about in the book that were going on at Princeton. By this time, it was the early 60s. My parents had met and fallen in love in sort of the mid to late 50s, which was the era of folk music and sort of the civil rights movement. By the early 60s, when they moved to Princeton, you're starting to have the sexual revolution. And so combined with this drinking was a lot of sort of promiscuity among the faculty, and my father fell into that too. So, and my mother wasn't completely aware, I think, until she gave up her tenured position at Swarthmore. I mean, imagine that. Mm. I mean, she was almost 10 years older. She was the more experienced professional. She had tenure. She was white. He was black. And yet, in that day and age, and this is the thing that I think later she sort of realized when she sort of had her feminist awakening, she still thought that the most important dynamic in their family was that he was the man and she was the woman. So she was the one who had to give up her career to follow him, even though he was still only a teaching assistant at Princeton. Anyway, so once she did that and we all moved to Princeton, she found out just how heavily he had started to drink, and she also started to find out about the other women.
One of your mother's main hesitations when you initially approached her with the idea that you might write this book was that she'd come across looking weak.
That's right. And I think for years, really, and this was sort of tied up with her depression after the divorce, she blamed herself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even though it was my father who had, you know, started to cheat on her, it was my father who ultimately, several years later, after we moved to Los Angeles, again, she moved because of him, a job opportunity. He's the one who had asked for a divorce. She thought somehow she had failed. She hadn't been a good enough wife. She maybe should have anticipated that he was too young and unprepared to be a responsible father, and that she had been too weak in the relationship and hadn't stood up to him enough. And it took really until, so they divorced in the early 60s, and eventually we came back to the East Coast with my mother, and it took her several years. She was teaching, again, having given up this tenured position at Swarthmore, had to resort to being a substitute teacher in high schools and teaching part-time in community colleges for 4 or 5 years before she finally got back on, got an opportunity for a full-time job in a small women's college in Massachusetts. And it wasn't until the very late 60s and the early 70s when feminism started to be a real topic of conversation at this college where we had landed, Wheaton, outside of Boston, that my mother started gradually, as she read the early feminist works and talked about it with her friends, started to realize that what had happened in the marriage, at least as far as she was concerned, wasn't just that she had been weak or a bad wife or a bad mother, but that she had, you know, in a way, been just sort of following the social code of the day. This is what women were expected to do. And I think ultimately that helped her a lot to sort of stop blaming herself and to get better and to have more perspective on what had happened between her and my father.
Yeah, she really comes across as a fascinating, I hate to call your mother a character, but individual, as you describe her in this book, because she's following the social codes in one way, and yet having married a black man in 1956 was really unusual. It's interesting that it doesn't sound like either one of your parents really thought about what the ramifications would be for you and your brother or for whatever children they would give birth to in having a mixed racial identity.
No, they didn't, and I think they were sort of both naive in that way. I mean, I think my father, I think my father just, you know, was a charmer. I mean, this is one of the things. I mean, I realized this later on, you know, as I got to know him, and you know that in our own relationship there was a big dynamic of charm and magnetism, but also his disappointing me over and over again, which was part of our relationship. I think it was sort of a challenge for him, you know, mm-hmm. the idea of wooing and winning a white woman who also happened to be his teacher. I mean, I think there were things intellectually and you know, physically that attracted him about my mother, but I think it was also, you know, just sort of the seducer in him. Whereas my mother, I think she just kind of, as she told me, as I was reporting the book, she just assumed it would turn out okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the good part of that is she wasn't prejudiced towards my father. Yeah. You know, she didn't even think about, you know, about that. And the fact is her family had been quite accepting of him, and vice versa. My father's family in Pittsburgh had been very accepting of her. That didn't apply, by the way, to the president of the college when his name was Courtney Smith at the time at Swarthmore. When he found out about it, he almost tried to deny my mother tenure. And you know, they had to get some civil rights leaders, Bayard Rustin and others, involved to make sure that she wasn't stripped of tenure because of their relationship. But, you know, I mean, you talked about my mother. You know, my mother is, I think, even though my father is the more flamboyant character in this book, my mother, I think, is just as interesting. And what is really interesting, and I knew, you know, to some degree, but I think I became even clearer to me, was this very interesting mixture of someone who, on the one hand, was incredibly shy, a little bit sheltered, in that she'd grown up in and remained as a professor in this sort of ivory tower world of ideas and books, and yet incredibly courageous in other ways. You know, as a 14-year-old, she had come to America by herself with her younger sisters to a completely new country to live with complete strangers or almost strangers during the war. She had married my father, which was a very courageous thing. She ultimately, even though she was sort of desperate at the time, did what she had to do to keep my brother and I safe after the divorce. So in a very quiet way, she is the hero of this book.
Mark Whitaker is my guest. He's executive vice president and managing editor of CNN Worldwide. His new book is called My Long Trip Home, a Family Memoir.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Mark Whitaker about his new book, My Long Trip Home, a Family Memoir. Mark, I suppose because, as you mentioned, you are light-skinned and your classmates in elementary school knew of your life only with your mother, who is white, you really didn't have occasion to necessarily cope with racism or with your black identity until you got to boarding school. Can you tell us a little bit about that process for you?
Well, that's right. I think after my parents divorced, my brother and I lived with my mother in these small college towns where there weren't a lot of black folks. I'm not even sure whether a lot of my classmates in elementary school and in junior high school knew I was black. But at the same time, my mother did keep us in touch with my father's family in Pittsburgh, even at a time when my father had stopped communicating with us and stopped sending her money. She still made it a point to take us every year, sometimes twice a year, to spend time with my grandmother and my aunts and my cousins in Pittsburgh. So I did have an experience of a black world through those visits, but it wasn't really till I got first to boarding school and then to college that I had to grapple with the whole issue of identity. And what had happened was, so this is by the mid 1970s, and there was starting at that point in the wake of the civil rights advances, as a lot of those kinds of schools, boarding schools and colleges where, you know, I went on scholarships, became more integrated, a lot of pressure for the black students to self-define as black and to spend most of their time with other black students, to eat at the black table, to when I got to college at Harvard to live in one of the houses there that was considered sort of the black house where black folks applied so they could live together. I always, even though some of those kids were my friends, I always felt uncomfortable with that, and I felt and didn't want to do that myself for a couple of reasons. One is I did have a white mother. I had grown up, in white worlds. So the idea that of kind of shutting that part of my life and my heritage off, I thought was just false and wrong. But also my father himself, and by this point, he had reentered my life, but in a sort of very turbulent way, because at this point he was really a chronic alcoholic, and I had a series of meetings and visits with him that kept getting ruined because he would start drinking again.
Yeah.
But still, we had enough of a relationship so that I knew that my father as well was someone who was determined not to let the fact that he was black, the color of his skin, limit him in terms of his opportunities and who his friends were or what his interests were. Even for all of the negative influences of my father, I was already kind of emulating him in that sense, that yes, I was proud of my black heritage, but I didn't want that to limit or confine me.
Yeah, he said this amazing thing to you, which is that the world has decided that you are black, but you get to decide how you want to be black.
That's exactly what he said. We had this discussion. He came to visit me at George School, which is the boarding school where I went as a teenager. I had been reading Richard Wright and James Baldwin and really sort of getting a better picture of what it was to be black in areas of America where, you faced racism every day. And I talked to my father about that and, where he sort of thought we were in terms of racism at the time in America. And he said, the first thing he said was, I've been waiting for you to ask me that question. And he said, what you have to understand is that in America, if you have, as far as Americans are concerned, you had any black blood, you're black. He had his mother's father had been so light-skinned in Pittsburgh that he passed in his job as working for the railway. But my grandmother, who was not that dark-skinned herself, or my great-grandmother, was afraid to visit him at his job because she was afraid that once the people saw her, they would realize that he was black and he would lose his job. So he said, look, you will always be black as far as America is concerned, he said, but it's up to you to decide how you want to be black. That was a very empowering thing for him to tell me.
So, your father was absent for a lot of your childhood. He struggled with alcoholism. As you've said, he disappointed you time and time again, and you would have these moments where you came together and they would kind of fall apart. You decided at some point that you had to get beyond your anger at him. I wonder if does that mean you could feel love for him, or did you feel that all along and were still so angry? Can you describe that for us?
Well, it was a long process. Eventually the drinking became so bad that after one visit that I described where literally I had to, sit there and just nurse him as he went through his withdrawal symptoms, I cut off contact with him. Early in my childhood, he had cut off contact with me. This time I cut off contact with him.
Yeah.
I went off to college, and 3 years later, I got a call from him, and he told me that he had stopped drinking and that this time he thought it was for good. It eventually took 6 months at an AA facility called Alina Lodge in rural New Jersey for him finally to stop drinking. But he did. And after that, We gradually developed a better relationship, although it was always a little bit wary and a little bit competitive, and he continued to be a sort of a difficult guy, and I was very proud, and I was off starting my own career and my own family and determined not to be like him. But I would say what happened, both once he retired eventually and I had achieved, you know, some success and enough success in my personal and my professional life that, you know, I could sort of develop a better relationship with him as well. But then also in the process of probably even more so after he died and I was, you know, compelled to write this book, I had always thought that the success I had as an adult was despite him. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I talk about how I thought it was almost a form of revenge, that I was going to show him what it was to be a good father, what it was to be a good husband, what it was to be, you know, a responsible professional, and that that had been a big motivating force in my life. And that I sort of done it all on my own. No thanks to him.
Mm-hmm.
What I discovered, and maybe this is the reason that I was, you know, I had this epiphany that I wanted to write this book. What I discovered in the course of reporting and writing this book actually is how much, despite everything, I still got from my father and that I got from my mother as well. And that the sources of my happiness and success as an adult were actually much more rooted in who my parents were, the good parts of my parents, the things that I had gotten from my grandparents on both sides, than I had realized or been willing to accept. So it's really, the book ultimately, I know it sounds like there's a lot of kind of unhappiness and dysfunction and so forth, but ultimately it's a book that seeks to understand who my parents were from a sympathetic point of view, ultimately, and ultimately how they affected my life, not just for ill, but also for good as well.
You're a father today. I wonder if you were apprehensive to a greater extent than any new father or father-to-be is about the decision to have children based on the way you had struggled growing up.
At the time, I was, and in fact, you know, I was very wary for a long time of even getting involved,
mm-hmm.
And having girlfriends, or at least, you know, at least sort of committed long-term relationships, because in my mind, it was, you know, if you got serious with a girl, you're going to end up marrying her, and then it was going to lead to divorce and unhappiness and so forth, and it took me until my early 20s till I finally met someone who I could really have a long-term relationship with. And again, I wasn't, at the time I met her, I wasn't even looking for it, but it just turned out that way. There was just something about her and our relationship that made me feel like I couldn't be without her, you know? But, you know, we were involved and lived together for 3.5 years before I proposed. But you know, even then, you know, we started talking about having children, and I was very uncertain about whether I could be a good father. But I was also, I was worried about that, but at the same time, I was very motivated to be a father, partly to show that I could be a good father.
Yeah.
And that I could do it the right way. And I could give my kids a love and security that I hadn't gotten from my father. And to some degree, I felt at the time, even my mother, although I ultimately realized that some of my anger towards my mother at the time was really much more about the circumstances after the divorce, that actually my mother had really given us all the love she had to give. It was just a very difficult time for her.
Has she read the book?
She has. She has. She was a big source for the book,
mm-hmm.
obviously. I couldn't have written it both without her agreeing to talk to me and also giving me a lot of letters that she had written and that people had written to her. She turned out actually to be much more, she was a little apprehensive at first, but she was very objective. First of all, she has remarkable recall. She's just turned 85, and I was lucky that I, you know, talked to her when I did, because, you know, she's, you know, she still remembers things clearly. Mm-hmm. But she was very, her main concern was that I get things right. It wasn't that I not talk about the things that were unpleasant, but that it be a true, accurate historical record. And then, of course, you know, she's also a literary professor. So finally, when I sent her the third draft, after reading it, she said, you know, this is not badly written.
High praise, then.
Yeah, which is high praise from my mother.
And you say at the end of the book that you also wrote this in part for your children. Is there anything that you and I haven't talked about today that you hope that they specifically take away from this?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of just the history and the genealogy and so forth that you know, I wanted them to know, and that I found fascinating that I hadn't known beforehand. You know, I kind of wanted them to know, you know, both why I cared so deeply for them and why they were so precious, and the fact, you know, my family is so precious to me. But also, you know, look, there have been times when my kids, you know, I think have been critical of me as a dad. You know, sometimes they...
That goes with the territory, I think. It's not just
well,
you.
Yeah, no, I know that's true. But, you know, I think, you know, sometimes, you know, I can be a little bit reserved. And, you know, I think that there are... I think they know... There were some times, I think, you know, as they got to know both of their grandparents, that they sensed that sometimes, you know, I had some ambivalent feelings about my parents. And, you know, why wasn't my relationship with my parents as kind of, you know, warm as my wife's relationship with her parents, for example? And, you know, I think they know that now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't want them to feel sorry for me or, you know, but I just wanted, you know, perhaps them to also understand that, you know, I was doing the best that I could.
Mark Whitaker is Executive Vice President and Managing Editor of CNN Worldwide. His book is called My Long Trip Home, a Family Memoir. Mark, it's a fascinating story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
It was a pleasure being here.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.